How many boys were in that pile, do you know?
Well, I would say there was about 8 or 10. And here's, you see this?
Scar right here on your face?
Yeah, they got me right there.
With a sword?
With a sword or bayonet. And I was in a pile of kids, you know. I couldn't cry. If I did, I wouldn't be here today.
It's because they thought you were dead.
They thought I was dead, yeah. So in the evening, the mothers and grandmothers, aunts, they went and picked up their kid that weren't dead yet. And those that were dead, they pushed into the river, Euphrates River, to go down. Others over there with their hands dug a grave in the sand on the shore and buried them.
That was the voice of Sam Kadorian, who escaped the genocide as a little boy. And welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, April is a notorious month for genocide and mass human rights abuses. We'll analyze the forces of genocide and the means of preventing future genocides. But first, we commemorate the Armenian genocide with a brief history and analysis and what it has meant for the development of human rights issues. We are joined by Peter Balakian. He's professor of humanities at Colgate University, award-winning writer and poet, and the author of at least 2 best-selling books, The Black Dog of Fate, his memoir. It won the Penn Martha Albrand Prize for Memoir and a New York Times notable book. And he also wrote The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response. Welcome to the show, Peter Balakian.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So in your book, The Burning Tigris, you describe living conditions for Armenians in the Ottoman Empire and other non-Muslim factions in the late 1800s prior to the genocide. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, to be Armenian in this case, or to be non-Muslim in the Ottoman Empire, meant that you were legally designated with infidel status. You were thought of as a non-believer, and the colloquial term was gavur, which was sort of a slang, a derogatory slang. Now, infidel status meant that you were relegated to a separate and not equal social, political, and economic status. Christians, for example, Armenians, for example, couldn't join the military. They couldn't join the civil service. They were taxed in a much more severe way, and in a way that really fleeced much of the agrarian community. They weren't allowed to own weapons. They weren't allowed to ride horses in urban areas. And they had no legal rights in Islamic courts of law. This was another way in which a property was extorted by Muslim overlords. Women were abducted, disappeared into harems and into slavery and so forth. So living with infidel status was very difficult.
Yeah, you quoted an ethnographer who said what it was like to be Armenian. He said they were dogs and pigs to be spat upon, if their shadow darkened a Turk, to be the mats on which he wiped the mud from his feet.
Yes, that was Mr. Ramsey, the British anthropologist and journalist who spent a lot of time in the Ottoman Empire in the latter part of the 19th century. It was often very difficult. And so Armenians in the latter part of the 19th century began to ask for some change, and that began to lead to trouble.
Can you get into some of that trouble?
I think it's important to understand the massacres of the Armenians in the 1890s that were conducted by Sultan Abdulhamid II, and then the genocide of the Armenians that was implemented by the Young Turk government as the result of what I would call a civil rights movement. Christian Armenians asking for reform and change, organizing political parties, protesting peacefully in the streets, demonstrating, petitioning, and asking the question, in my opinion, they asked the fundamental question, can a Christian be the equal of a Muslim in the Ottoman Empire? And the answer was meted out very decidedly no, and then the no was expressed in wholesale violence and massacre. Interestingly enough, the first real conflict, I would say, or at least the first dramatic conflict between reform-oriented Armenians and their Turkish and Kurdish overlords was over taxes, where Armenians stood up and refused to pay the fifth round of fleecing of the taxes in that spring season in 1894. And when they were fired on You know, they stood up. They didn't go away. They fired back, and that led to a wholesale massacre of what would end up as some 200,000 innocent civilians being massacred by the Sultan in the 1890s. The plan to exterminate the entire Armenian population, about 2.5 million Armenians living on their historic homeland of some 2,500 years, so that's important to understand. The plan to exterminate the Armenians was hatched by the Young Turk government, or better known as its political party, Committee of Union and Progress, that had taken power in Turkey in 1913, and the government was run by Minister of the Interior Talat Pasha, Minister of War Enver Pasha, Minister of the Marine Cemal Pasha. And the Minister of the Interior Talat was the mastermind, along with his high-ranking CUP officials, in a project to use the moment of World War I as a screen behind which to exterminate the Armenian population. And this was very well planned and organized, and I think that's important to understand, because the Turkish government today, in denying the Armenian genocide, would like the world to think that this was not organized. Well, this was one of the most efficiently organized genocides in history. It was carried out by a special bureau of the Committee of Union and Progress called the Special Organization, the SO. And the SO, under the leadership of Talat and one of his high-ranking bureaucrats, a physician named Dr. Bedahin Shakir, the SO established mobile killing squads to do massacring all over what is today Turkey, all over Anatolia and Asia Minor. And how were those killing squads created? They were created by the releasing of some 30,000 convicts from prison. Now, this takes a lot of planning and organization. I think it's important to note that emergency executive legislation was used. A temporary law of deportation was passed in May of 1915, and something called the temporary law of confiscation and expropriation was passed in September of 1915. And these parliamentary acts, temporary as they were, legitimized and expedited the government's ability to arrest every Armenian man, woman, and child throughout Turkey and place them on deportation, as they were called. But deportation meant massacre. It meant, really, death march. Technology was used. Armenians were put into boxcars in the western part of Turkey, cattle cars made for a dozen animals were stuffed with 80, 90, 100 men, women, and children. We think of that as only belonging to the Holocaust, but it really started with the Young Turk government in 1915. So these were some of the methods of organization. And so it's also, again, important to note that there was a very systematic approach to the Armenian population, so that the intellectual elite were wiped out often first. Professors, writers, poets, journalists, playwrights, community leaders were killed, were rounded up. And this, of course, is the event that Armenians worldwide use to commemorate the beginning of the Armenian genocide on April 24, because it was on that night in 1915 that about 250 intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople were first arrested and sent on trains to the interior, where most of them were tortured and killed. And the idea here is, of course, that you cut the head off of the culture, you pull its tongue out. And again, it allows us to see the systematic plan in motion.
Now, you also gave this genocide a particularly important role in both world history and American history. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I think it's important to understand the groundbreaking nature of the Armenian genocide. First, it really began the age of genocide, modern genocide. Genocide exists as far back as recorded history. We can find episodes and examples of race extermination. But modern genocide suggests the use of technology and state bureaucracy implemented for the purpose of liquidating an ethnic or culture group of people in a concentrated period of time. And the first time that was done was in 1915 by the Ottoman Turkish government against the Armenians. So that The Armenian Genocide inaugurates modernity, the darkest side and chapter of modernity. The genocides that follow it all owe something to it. Adolf Hitler said 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. And Hitler, of course, was inspired by the fact that the Young Turk government had done what it had done to the Armenians. Secondly, the Armenian Genocide is crucial to understanding World War I, just the way the Holocaust is crucial to understanding World War II. It was the former President Theodore Roosevelt who said that the Armenian massacre was the greatest crime of the war. Thirdly, I think it's important to note that the Armenian Genocide really played an interesting, important role in the evolution of modern human rights and international law. And Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the term genocide, did so in part on the basis of what happened to the Armenians in 1915, as well as what was happening to the Jews of Europe before his very eyes. So that the Armenian event is, shall we say, etymologically part of the evolution of the term genocide. And then, yes, you mentioned my point in The Burning Tigris that the Armenian Genocide plays an important role in American history. It spawned the first international human rights movement in this country. And by that, I mean it's the first time Americans came together to go overseas in body, in person, to give aid and bring relief to a people who were being murdered en masse thousands of miles away. And really, the first international human rights movement in this country begins with the Armenian massacres of the 1890s. It's Clara Barton who takes the Red Cross overseas for the first time in February of 1896. She spends most of that year with her Red Cross teams. She's in Constantinople, and the Red Cross teams are in the provinces rebuilding the Armenian economy. Americans spoke out in huge numbers, elite Americans, intellectuals, reformers, political leaders, as well as the broad populace, a grassroots movement. Julia Ward Howe, Clara Barton, I mentioned, Stephen Crane, William and Henry James, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, Theodore Roosevelt, William Jennings Bryan, Ezra Pound, H.L. Mencken, and so on, are among the voices that speak out on the Armenian issue over the course of four decades. And Americans also give enormous amounts of money through an NGO. Well, many NGOs, really, starting in the 1890s, but the most famous was the foundation called Near East Relief, which in the end would give close to $110 million in aid for, as they were called, the starving Armenians. And if you tabulate that by today's currency, it comes to something like $1.3 billion. So we have this extraordinary outpouring from Americans, again, from Sunday schools and churches and synagogues, to major industrialists like John D. Rockefeller Jr. And Sr. as well, the Ford Foundation, the Carnegies, the Mellons, and so forth. So it galvanized a big piece of America for almost four decades, from the 1890s into the early 1920s.
Peter Balakian, I wonder if you could say if you think recognizing the Armenian Genocide today still matters. Before you go into that, the other thing I wanted you to add was the double killing aspect that you addressed with regards to denial.
Well, as I say, you know, when any human rights crime goes unacknowledged by the perpetrator and unpunished, I think we have a grave kind of moral and ethical situation. The denial is a kind of ethical concept that scholars have developed over the recent decades, especially in the wake of Holocaust denial, and now even more dramatically in the wake of the denial of the Armenian Genocide by the Turkish government. When you have denial, you have a very serious moral problem, and scholars in the genocide community continue to reiterate that the denial of genocide is the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. And it sends the message that genocide doesn't matter. It demands no moral accountability. And, of course, it encourages, it paves the way for more genocide to come. I think Elie Wiesel has eloquently used the term double killing to talk about how denial kills the memory of the event as well. And Robert J. Lifton has noted that in the case of denial, a counterfeit reality is created that attempts to rob the survivor population and the legacy population of the victims of moral order. So I think the Turkish government is being asked to deal with its past in a moral way, and that the more it engages in extreme propaganda of denial and hysteria, I think the more it impedes its own progress as a country that's now seeking to join Europe and become part of a democratic society. But I think that genocide, the study of genocide first, is important, whether we study the Armenian case, the Jewish case, the Rwandan case, or the Cambodian case. We are studying genocide so we can learn how the worst can happen, how the ultimate human crime can happen, and what we might as citizens do to understand why these catastrophes happen and how we might work to prevent. I mean, obviously, the goal in studying genocide is also about prevention and about engaging us in action in the present. Anybody who cares about the Armenian genocide should be engaged in what's going on in Sudan in the Darfur region, should be engaged in the lessons of Rwanda and the Holocaust and Pol Pot's genocide in Cambodia, so that in the end, this is, of course, urgently about species preservation. It's about the ultimate issues of our survival as a human race. And the Armenian case has a lot to teach us. And as I've just noted, it has a lot to teach us about the importance of justice. A genocide denied by an unrepentant government, as the Turkish government is today, creates a grave moral problem and a demon that won't go away, for not only for the perpetrator and the victim culture, but really for the world.
Peter Balakian, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Balakian is a professor of humanities at Colgate University and the author of Black Dog of Fate and also The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide in America's Response. Stay tuned.
The following interview with Ben Bagdingian was recorded in April 2005. He passed away on March 11, 2016.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Ben Bagdingian was born just before the second part of the Armenian Genocide. He was an infant when his family escaped. Ben Bagdingian is the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley and is one of the foremost American journalists and media critics. Ben Bagdingian has won many of the highest journalism awards and has authored 6 books, including In the Midst of Plenty, The Poor in America, The Information Machines, The Effet Conspiracy and Other Crimes by the Press, Double Vision, Reflections on My Heritage, Life and Profession, and the Media Monopoly. Listeners are familiar with much of Ben Bagdingian's work, but what some are not as familiar with are his family history and its impact on his work. Welcome to the show, Ben Bagdingian.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. In your memoirs, Double Vision, you describe your family's exodus from Armenia during the time of the Armenian Genocide. Can you tell that story to our listeners?
I was born in Turkey during the last of the massacres of Armenians by the Turks. And we were forced to flee when I was 11 days old over frozen mountains. And we were lucky that we all survived, though a few years later as a result, my mother died. But at that time, this was after the main genocide of 1915-1916, as we left, my older sisters, I had 4 older sisters who were old enough to remember, who saw Armenian churches into which most of the Armenians had been forced in, and the churches had been set on fire. So there, just within Marash, during that week, 5,000 Armenians were killed by the Turks. And that's just one incident, one day, 1 week, in the fading days of the genocide.
So how did your family manage to survive and then manage to escape?
Well, because my father was an extraordinary man. He had been a professor at an American college in Tarsus, Turkey, and he was asked after World War I to organize the educational system in that area. And so he had some standing in the community, and we were able to salvage a horse, my mother's horse, whose name was Mozart. And by his incredible efforts of keeping the family going, while thousands, according to the French record, which I have looked at in Paris, of the retreating French troops and of the retreating Armenians froze to death, my father's efforts kept us going, kept us alive, built fires during the night somehow, and we escaped with the last of the retreating French troops miles away from the railroad center to the south of the city where I was born.
So your family was under French protection, and that was part of why you survived.
Yes, we were lucky. We were, and most of my relatives, Armenian relatives, had members of their family who froze to death on that march or who were killed by the Turks directly. And the remaining Armenians in the city who could not get away, as I say, 5,000 of those were killed by the Turks. And that is a very small number in the fading days of the genocide.
This was what year, roughly?
This was the 1920.
And how long did it take for your family to escape?
It took 5 days to go over the mountains with deep snow, sub-freezing weather. My wife and I researched the records, military records in France, and their troops suffered hundreds of losses through freezing and through Turkish troops firing on the fleeing people.
Now, you went back to your family's old village years later. What was your experience?
I wanted to see the city where I was born, where I'd left when I was 11 days old. And I found, in the beginning, a modern city with double-barrel streets with pretty flowers and a median, and then went on to what was an abandoned older city where very large buildings were still intact, which was the American Congregationalist High School, built by American Congregationalist missionaries, and college, where both my parents were educated. My father later got his graduate degree in American University. And that older part of the city, except for those two buildings, which were padlocked, was in rubble, the site where our family would have lived and where the hospital I was born was just rubble, had been all been destroyed. And I had also been there earlier as a foreign correspondent and went to Turkey. I think individual Turks, in our own experience, according to my family, during the fleeing in the last days of the genocide, had been friends, and a few were willing to hide people, but most, of course, were under orders of the leaders of the genocide to kill the Armenians. And they were, of course, in World War I, allies of Germany. Turkey was an ally of Germany against Russia, Great Britain, France, and the United States. So we were very fortunate. And most of the relatives we have now, or did have in my childhood, had members of their family who were not so lucky.
Do you think that your heritage and your family's history has impacted your journalism?
Well, I think subconsciously, it did lead me to that. But certainly as a journalist, I was always very sensitive to observe directly a phenomenon that was going on with my own ears and eyes, report it accurately, without prejudice, so that there would be a record. And it made me sensitive, I think, to people who had their own problems in life and I spent a great deal of time with such people. I did a book on the poor in America. In many ways, I think, either subconsciously and then later consciously, I saw the need for precise, accurate reporting with sufficiently sound background in which some phenomenon was happening. I did not depend on official communiques, which are usually partially untrue, but on what I could discover on my own, talking to frontline troops and being present at events. I covered the misfortunes of people and being sensitive to it, but also as I covered government, because as I.F. Stone once said, every journalist should understand one thing. All governments lie sometime. But every government, every public official puts himself and herself in the best light. Whether that was influenced by my family history, I don't know. It certainly was subconsciously part of that. I also spent a great deal of time dealing with the outcasts of the society, the poor. I did stories about prisons and the necessity of not being swayed by official reports or cynical about what people tell you, because you check on them as much as you can. I have learned my own family history due to the accounts that became reliable of what others reported at the time.
Have you ever looked at how the media handled the Armenian Genocide?
What has happened for many, many years is that Turkey, up to the present time, has denied that there was an organized program to kill Armenians. All the documentary evidence is otherwise. Lord Bryce of England had a very famous book in which he used eyewitnesses all over the Armenian-occupied places of Turkey for eyewitnesses' account. The ambassador, U.S. ambassador at the time to Turkey, Henry Morgenthau, wrote in his cables back to the United States what was happening to the Armenians. He cites one instance which is in the archives of the State Department, when one of the two leaders of the genocide, Enver Pasha, called him in and said, "Ambassador, we have now got rid of the Armenians. Many of them had insurance policies with American insurance companies, and I demand those policies because these Armenians were Turkish subjects." And in his book and in the archives of the cables to the State Department, Ambassador Morgenthau says, "I will do no such thing." But it is in the cables. It's in the archives of the United States, in the archives of Germany, the archives of Britain, the archives of France, so that the documentary history is unmistakable, but yet Turkey continues to deny that it happened. And the media, for a very long time, certainly up until about 5 or 10 years ago, referred to the alleged genocide of the Armenians, because each time they did what is one of the problems in journalism. Journalism should always listen to both sides. But in a he said, she said argument, it is not usually true that one side is all right and the other side is all wrong. So every time there would be a memorial for the Armenian genocide, the newspapers would then go to the local Turkish embassy or consulate, and the Turkish representative would say, "No such thing happened." Therefore, the newspapers would refer to the alleged genocide. I think they no longer do that. It is now so clear. The documentary evidence and studies are so overwhelming that I think there are very few papers of any reputation that refer it now to an allegation.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Remember. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guests participated in a standing room only live forum that explored the roots of violence and genocide, what they have in common, and what it takes to prevent and to heal in their aftermaths. Our experts are University of Auckland Political Studies lecturer Chris Wilson, sociology professor Tracy McIntosh, and University of Technology lecturer Panayotis Diamandis. I think we'll start, Panayotis Diamandis, with you to talk about the three peoples who were targeted at this particular time, why it occurred, and what actually happened.
Thank you for the invitation. I think that the reasons for why the genocides happened were covered in the video quite succinctly. One thing it doesn't cover is that this was a campaign against all Gavur, all infidels, the Yazidis, all different branches of the Assyrians, so the Syriac Orthodox, the Church of the East, the Syriac Catholics, the Chaldean Catholics, all of them. And of course my own people, the Hellenes or the Greeks. This was a campaign to Turkify, to start by Islamizing the empire, whatever territories they could retain. And phase two was to eliminate Kurdish identity and Turkify everybody. The few small communities in the major cities were to be tolerated, but not in any great proportions, not in any great numbers serious enough to threaten control of the state. And make no bones about it, make no mistake, this is all about power. As it quite succinctly said there at the beginning after Sadiq Hamish, this was a campaign against minority groups. By the way, nobody was majority of the Ottoman Empire. There were majorities in particular districts, but overall, no one group had a majority of the population. Before the Balkan Wars, I would say the split was roughly 60% Muslim across the empire, 40% Christian. And that includes very heavily Muslim areas like Syria, what is now Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel slash Palestine. The campaigns actually began straight after the Balkans Wars. So this is early 1913, coming into the beginning of 1914. Campaigns started in the western part of the empire, particularly in a region that I know as Thrace. You guys know it as Gallipoli. Some of the earliest expulsions, deportations, were of the Greeks of Gallipoli. And by the way, there was an Armenian church in Gallipoli, in the town of Gallipoli. And this is one thing, particularly this year in 2015, that we need to remind anybody associated with Anzac, that we are talking about the native peoples, the indigenous peoples of these areas. They were there first. Now, some people may consider that a controversial statement to make, but that's the reality. My people have been on the western shores, the eastern shores of the Aegean and on the Black Sea coast for about 4,000 years. The Armenians and the Assyrians have a presence there even older than that in their parts of the region. So the connection to Gallipoli is not just dates. Some of the earliest victims of the genocide were the Armenian community of Gallipoli town. Why? Because it controls access to the imperial capital, Constantinople. The guy who came up with the idea of cleansing all the infidels from the backyard of the imperial capital was not Mustafa Kemal. I refuse to use the name that they used in the film. His honorific title. His mother named him Mustafa. His nickname was Kemal, so that's the end of the story. His name was Mustafa Kemal, who wasn't a Turk, by the way. His father was Albanian, his mother was Greek. Islamized, but her first language at home was Greek. We have accounts from Greek prisoners of war that she would interview because they were from her hometowns in what we now call Western Macedonia, so Florina Kastoria, for those of you who know Greece. And his father was an Albanian, minor tax official. The real guy at Gallipoli who was in charge of Gallipoli was a guy called Limon von Sanders. Yes, German. And he writes in his own memoir about the time, I'm the one who said that we cannot have a hostile population. Listen to that word, hostile population in the backyard of the empire. So you have the expulsions and deportations happening from 1913, 1914. By the time the war begins in August of 1914, you've got 300,000 refugees in Greece. The war hasn't started, and you've already got 300,000 people expelled. Literally, in 24 hours, pack whatever you can carry and be gone. Otherwise, we will kill you. The ones who didn't believe it were killed. And we've got all sorts of documentary. The role of journalists was supreme, not only in causing it, but also in documenting what was happening. Now, one of the newspaper items that they showed up there mentioned a town called Karahisar, and I love the ambassador's comment there about, oh, the deportations were only in the eastern part of the empire because it was a war zone, and, you know, things happened, we wanted to evacuate them. Karahisar was about 1,500 kilometres from the nearest war zone. It's about 1,500 kilometres from Gallipoli. It's in the western part of Anatolia. It's a major railway junction. Ah, railways. Come back to that in a minute. The parallels with the Shoah, with the Holocaust, are staggering and are only now beginning to be really, really examined. Before I go on another rant. Karahisar. Today it's called Afyon Karahisar, is how you'll find it on maps and on Google. It was a POW camp. There were a number of houses, a whole neighbourhood, and a particular building in this town. The remnants of the building and the houses are still there. We've got photos of them, footage of them. This is where Anzacs were held prisoner. Anzacs captured at Gallipoli. Now, hands up, who actually knew we had Anzac POWs in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, in 1915? Three. At least 25 of them were Kiwis. I'm having a dispute now with some other scholars, but it's between 250 and 300 were Australian. A number of them were here, in this town called Afyon. The church was Our Lady Mother of God, Armenian Apostolic Church of Afyon. That was their prison camp. The altar areas where the officers were, because it was most sheltered from the winds. The closer you were to the door, the lower your rank. So the privates basically got exposed to the worst of the cold and the worst of the heat. We have their diaries, the ones who survived, because a third of them didn't survive. We have their diaries saying, this is what the locals told us. We have diaries from one Victorian guy, an Australian called Luscombe. You can Google all these names, all this stuff. It's all on the internet now. I love the internet. Talking about the deportation train of Armenian women and children at Afyon. An Anzac witnessing the deportations, 1,500 kilometres from the nearest battlefront. We have another Australian who later became a minister in the Menzies government, for those of you who know much about Australian history. A guy called Thomas Walter White. He was a pilot. He was shot down near a place called Azizia. It's north of Basra in today's Iraq. He was marched up through Mosul. These places sound familiar to some of you? Yeah? Across north of Deir Zor, but to Ras El Ain, and then over the Taurus Mountains, past a place called Birecik. That's why I mentioned it. While they're crossing the mountains, he writes, I saw a deportation column going the other way. And we know where they'd passed through because there were dead bodies and bones all along the route that we walked across in the other direction. He stopped at north of Mosul at a town called Tel Armin and talks about nothing but dogs being left alive there. The locals were quite proud of it, of what had happened. Yeah, we cleaned them out. Now, I've been informed that there is a recognition campaign in New Zealand. We need somebody to go to either to the National Archives. I'm not sure whether they're in Wellington or Auckland. Go to the War Memorial. Because all this stuff I've told you about the POWs is in the War Memorial in Canberra. The originals are still there. This is not me making stuff up. You can actually go. I can give you the file numbers. You can go and look at the originals. These are 100-year-old documents now. There were Kiwis there. There were Kiwis involved in the relief effort. The women, Jakobsen, Maria Jakobsen, the women that were bought, they were bought out of captivity, particularly from Kurdish, but also from Arab tribes. Where'd the money come from to buy these women out of captivity? Basically ransomed. Australia and New Zealand were big contributors. When Smydney was destroyed in September of 1922, Australia donated $100,000, $1922 dollars, tens of millions in today's currency, in relief. We've succeeded in getting two of our six states in Australia, because we're a federation, like the US, to officially recognise, to adopt motions of recognition. The reason we achieved this is because, one, the three communities have worked together. They have pushed their local members, convinced them, basically, that this deserves recognition and that it is historical fact. Two, we convinced them that it's Australian history. If you look at the actual resolutions, because it's Australian history, it's now mine, so therefore I've got to recognise it. This is how it will happen in New Zealand as well. We have to make all three genocides New Zealand history, and then we'll succeed.
Thank you, Paniotis. Chris Wilson, specialist in conflict, war and genocide and terrorism. Can you put this into context for us?
I'll try and do so. What I'm going to try and do is talk about these sort of killings in the contemporary context. The best way to commemorate or to remember the victims of the genocide against the Armenians and the Holocaust and other genocides and mass killings in history is to try and prevent it happening again. So that's what I'm going to try and talk about the contemporary situation at the moment. It's not a particularly positive talk, I guess. It's a rather pessimistic talk that has something to do with my personality. Also has something to do with having done about 12 years of field work in violent conflict zones, most recently about 3 months ago, and coming back and seeing things that were on a much, much smaller scale, of course. And so this is not to try and belittle something like the Armenian Genocide or the Holocaust, but to just to point to the fact that there are things like this happening on a smaller scale, in some cases, you know, not that much smaller at the moment, that are not being referred to at the moment. So that's something I want to move to. And I'm going to do so with reference to what seems to be a growing orthodoxy at the moment, that we're living in a particularly peaceful era. The long peace, it's referred to the 70 years since World War II. People are starting to say, you know, we've finally made it. The principles of the Enlightenment have come to fruition, and we've put all the stuff behind us. So I just want to make a few points that I think that's perhaps misguided. And it rests on a little bit of a focus on perhaps Europe and the West and missing what's happening in developing regions of the world. I just want to start off by saying a few points on the study of genocide and some of the commonalities. Obviously, there's been quite a few genocides now over the past century. And so social science scholars, political scientists will try and look for commonalities in these genocides to try and understand them. Many of them are structural factors, and this is not to take away the human agency from them and therefore to take away the blame from those who are responsible for them, but to point to some of the common structural factors or conditions. There are a number of common factors that have been seen across most of the genocides, the important genocides of the last 100 years. Perhaps one of them, which is growing into an orthodoxy and seems to be reasonably solid, although I thought so until 5 minutes ago, is the correlation with war. Most scholars would now point to that genocide, there is a strong connection between genocide and war. Most of the major genocides of the past 100 years have occurred within the context of war. The Armenian genocide in World War I, the Holocaust in World War II, the Rwandan genocide in the context of a civil war between Hutus and Tutsis, the Cambodian genocide, ideological genocides like the Cambodian genocide, which occurred in the context of the wars in French Indochina and the series of wars there, even the ideological genocide in Indonesia in 1965 and 66, in the context of the Cold War, if you like. Why is this the case? Some of the arguments are that in a context of war, society becomes more militarized, weapons are more prevalent, people are more nationalistic, nationalism starts to rise, but also people are more amenable to follow orders, people are more susceptible to authority and not question authority. There are a number of reasons why there does seem to be this correlation between genocide and war. So another way of framing this question of, is genocide likely to happen again or can it happen again, is to change the question around a little bit. Is it possible that there's going to be a war, a major war, that will allow this type of genocide to occur again? Because it does, as I say, it does seem to be in that context. Now, this brings me to this growing consensus. It seems to be that we are living in a particularly peaceful era. This is most prominently and recently associated with a psychologist from Harvard known as Steven Pinker, who has released a book which is a bestseller. It makes the argument, it's called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And it makes the argument that since the Enlightenment, since the late 1700s, the 1800s, there have been these principles of reason, growing reason, of growing tolerance, that ideas that war is irrational, and these have been growing since the 1800s, and war has been declining ever since. Now, according to Pinker, the catastrophes that we are looking at, we just watched a movie about and we've been hearing about, and the Holocaust and other catastrophes like we've seen in the first half of the 20th century, according to Pinker, were a blip, not to be too silly about it, but are seen as a bit of a backlash against these Enlightenment ideals that are progressing. And this is a counter-Enlightenment backlash. But according to Pinker, these were rather contingent events and could be pretty much, talking about the Holocaust and World War II, could be pretty much summarized in the small statement, no Hitler, no war, and no Holocaust. There were contingent events that were led by individuals and so on. And according to Pinker, we have gone back, since World War II, we've gone back to this progress of Enlightenment ideals, and that's why we've seen 70 years of no major war. And this is not a fluke. It's because of these progress from the Enlightenment ideals, and it's basically been summarised as moral progress. Now, my argument is that this growing consensus makes this era particularly dangerous. This makes it particularly dangerous to another event like this happening, when people become very, very confident that these forces have gone and we don't have to worry about them anymore. Because I would argue that they have not gone. Enlightenment ideals, positive liberal Enlightenment ideals, have always been in constant contestation with nationalism, with the sort of ideals that we saw in the movie and that we're thinking about in terms of these genocides. There's a constant contestation and they have not gone away. And again, this is something that I've seen in my fieldwork in many areas, that there are these forms of nationalism wax and wane and become very strong depending on political institutions, depending on context, political context, and depending on the paranoia of power, if you like. There are things that bring these forces of nationalism back to the fore, and in many places they are right at the fore of what's happening. And this is another problem with this growing consensus, is that it's very much focused on the developed world and forgets what's happening in the developing world. And in many areas of the developing world, life is still very brutish and short, to paraphrase Hobbes. So this is one of the main problems for me, is that it ignores what's happening in many areas of the world in which many people are still dying because of their identity. And I know this because just a few months ago I left my last period of fieldwork where several hundred people had been killed just because of their ethno-religious identity, and I left the field and came back to here to continue teaching, very, very concerned that more was likely to happen. Within a week of coming back, another 40 people had been massacred. And these are state-led, these are massacres by political leaders. As I say, these are much, much smaller events than what we're looking at here. But within each of these, and there are thousands of them occurring simultaneously as we speak, and within each of these there are the seeds of terrible events like the ones that we're thinking of. There are the seeds of genocide. And I just want to make one other point, and this is to bring it down right from that very macro point down to a much more micro point, and that is the question of who is it who commits these genocides? And can you and I commit them? I mean, this is the question that's always interested me, and because it's always quite reassuring to think that these genocides are committed by people who are psychotic, sadistic, who are somehow abnormal and outside the norm. But studies time and time again have proved that this is not the case. In the Holocaust, in Tarahumwe, in Rwanda, these are normal people who have families, engage in charitable work, who have very normal lives, but then somehow become engaged in genocide. It's very much normal people. So how is it that people like you and I can end up committing these genocides and these mass killings? I just want to pose two quick arguments before I finish. There are a number of arguments in how people like us can end up committing these types of genocides, because this is something that we need to keep in mind, because the danger is always there and ordinary society can quickly move towards a genocidal society, and we need to keep that in mind. The first argument is what is known as gradualism, and that is very much to do with prejudice. And so the argument is that it's not one major leap from lives like ours into genocide, it's tiny little steps of escalating steps of prejudice. We start off thinking of people from another ethnic community as somehow all the same, not looking at them as individuals. And then we start making jokes about them, and we start avoiding them. And then we start thinking, perhaps, electing leaders who are more discriminatory and start enacting laws that take away their rights. And then we start telling the authorities that that's where they live, and then soon enough we're engaging in violence, and the most horrific violence that you can imagine. So that, in one leap, that seems totally unbelievable, but each of those steps is not that inconceivable by themselves, and so that's something we need to keep in mind. The second argument is this question of authority, and people are prone to following authority, particularly when it's seen as legitimate. The Milgram experiments, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, have shown that ordinary people are willing to cause terrible pain, perhaps even death, as long as they believe that they are following orders of a legitimate authority. In the Milgram experiments, people were asked by a scientist to ask questions of a person who was an actor in another room, in another cubicle, and if they got it wrong, they would give them an electric shock. And each time they got it wrong, they would turn the voltage up, and some people would say, I'm not that comfortable with this, and then the scientist would say, please continue, and they would keep going. And it showed that the vast majority of people were willing to go almost all the way to the end. 65% of people went all the way to the maximum voltage, which was known as fatal. And so they were hearing screams from the other side, and then with the top voltage, it went silent. And 65% of people were willing to do that. So it's something that needs to be kept in mind, and I just want to make those points because these are, in terms of policy prescriptions, these are things to keep these questions off small pieces of prejudice and the way we think of other groups, and also not wanting to be too much of a radical, but perhaps to rebel against authority when it is asking you to do terrible things to the marginalised. Thank you. I'll leave it there.
Tracy McIntosh.
Kia ora hui hui mai tato, kia ora koutou kato. It's a real honour for me to be here. I want to acknowledge the people that are here and recognise as a Māori woman that dead are always amongst us. There's a whole lot of things that I want to think about in terms of my own sort of work around genocide. In 1984, well, in the early 80s, I lived in Burundi and Rwanda. So 10 years prior to the genocide of Rwanda. I want to position that, I guess, in speaking to both of you and speaking to what we have seen today. And I'm really wanting to put that in terms of, you know, if I'm thinking about Steven Pinker's timeline, that timeline absolutely aligns with some of the most massive forms of violence in terms of the colonization period. And recognizing, you know, as you noted, in terms of the Amerindian, the genocide, the fact that Australia has largely been founded on near successful and sometimes successful genocides, repeated forms of genocide, that in New Zealand, whilst violence was largely used as a way to pacify people, and again we saw that in the film, that there were genocidal acts. But in speaking of that, I'm wanting to really sort of focus about a number of things. If we think about 10 years before the Armenian genocide and think about the genocide of the Herero people in Southwest Africa and present-day Namibia, where there we can see systematic, structural elimination, well, attempted elimination of a people. And that the people who were involved, the perpetrators of that genocide, it's particularly the young soldiers, young German soldiers, 18, 20, 22, if you saw the names of some of those soldiers, who were very young men at the time, their names would be familiar to you, because one of them went on to be the commander of Auschwitz, others became leading members in the Gestapo, that they did their training in the colonial grounds. And you know, the Herero people, the silence that we have around the Armenian and the Hellenic Assyrian genocides is certainly amplified, that silence is amplified by the silence around the genocide of the Herero people in 1905. In Southwest Africa as a part of a colonial form. So there's a real sort of, you know, again, around those silences, I'm wanting just to focus in the very short time that I have with you around some of these narratives of genocide. And it really came out strong, and like you, Chris, very interested around legitimacy and interrogation of legitimating strategies that we see as a constant sort of focus within genocidal narratives. So we have the narratives of the survivors. And these are incredibly important. You know, they're testimony, they're witnessing. They're when the witnessing, the diaries that you speak about become more important than the action, that the diary survives, that the testimony survives, that the witnessing survives, even if those that have witnessed it do not survive, becomes more important. And we see, certainly in terms of the Holocaust in Rwanda, and where that becomes, you know, what will happen if the diary doesn't survive. You know, you actually have people speaking about that all the time. Their own lives have become secondary because it's the witnessing that is important. And in many ways, what we get with the narratives of survivors, even those who do not survive, is this absolute articulation of the experiential reality, which again, of the film that we've seen today, just, you know, how important that is, how searing that is in regards to teaching us as a learning space around our own humanity and our own inhumanity. The articulating of the unimaginable, that often at the reach of genocide, you know, one of the, you know, Samantha Powell and others have argued, Olga Clenodin has argued the same thing, that in many ways, when we're faced with it, it's unimaginable. And so to deny it for some becomes easier. That we can see these aberrant acts, these, you know, aberrations that have occurred, but this was not systemic, you know, there's no systemic structural forces in play. But that's one of the things that's really struck me in my work is the incredible power of the imagination. These things were imagined and they were implemented. The narratives of perpetrators, I think, is where we get the most clearest strategies, and again, we've seen witness of that tonight, of descendants of perpetrators, at least, in terms of the need for real legitimating strategies. It incurred in times of conflict. Everyone was at war. You know, there was no, I mean, someone said that, you know, you must, well, he said it in the UN, no less, you must be totally innocent. This notion around innocence is that one can only be the entirely vulnerable, completely innocent to actually be a legitimate victim of atrocity, of abuse, of genocide. And so these narratives of perpetrators, that they recognize that their attempts to colonize the future, and the way that we think about things, the way we understand things, the way we make sense of things, has been undermined by these other strategies coming up. And I think that's particularly in what we saw tonight, that sort of sense of that need to control history, to control what is said in history, so that they can colonize the future in terms of the way that we look back and we think. You know, it is very interesting about what we remember and what we forget. France has put up a memorial to the Armenian genocide. They're not so keen on memorials around Algeria. And I think the last sort of things that I want to think about the narratives of silence, and I think that these play in two ways. We have the narratives of silent, of those who could have said something but didn't, and we look to international communities, we look to individuals, we look to a whole range of people, where they are the bystanders and the collective bystanders, and I absolutely agree that do we recognize today when genocide is occurring? Are we open to it? Do we want to see it? Do we want to see it happening very close to us, West Papua and other places where you have genocidal acts that are occurring? Do we recognize genocide? Is genocide something that we only ever see in looking back? Can we never recognize it when it's in front of us? We know that in terms of the Rwandan genocide, you know, an absolute memo was put forward. Do not mention genocide. Use the word genocidal act if you have to. Do not use the word genocide, because if you use the word genocide, then under the convention you have to act. Be careful when you use the word genocide. And the last narrative is the narratives of those that are silenced, where they have not survived. And in many cases there are no traces that have survived at all. And so we recognize that there are those that have been killed through in genocide that we do not remember, that they are silenced. And I think that's an important one.
Our guests participated in a standing room only live forum that explored the roots of violence and genocide, what they have in common, and what it takes to prevent and to heal in their aftermaths. Our experts are University of Auckland Political Studies lecturer Chris Wilson, sociology professor Tracy McIntosh, and University of Technology lecturer Panayotis Diamandis.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.